So I've been thinking a bit recently, Camilla and Keith, about the notion of getting celebrities to help with your charitable cause. And this comes about because I've been chasing a well-known actress who has a relative in the military to do something for a military charity. And she has an extraordinary amount of followers on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all of that sort of stuff.
My experience from that is that there's two types, I think. One who are generally interested in the cause, and normally they're associated with someone who's actually running it, that there's been that named link, so therefore they've got that easy contact with them.
Maybe there's something that's beyond that, which is kind of luck and common cause. The Borough Market, when it started out, it had lots of people who came who had their own reputations. Jamie Oliver started out there, and he had a lot of his first and early cookbooks photographed in the market, and he talked about it a lot, and then people came to the market because of Jamie Oliver. There was this sort of zeitgeist thing that happens. There's something really magical about it because it isn't a deal.
Griffiths Jones is the one that I'm probably more familiar with because he's a patron of the theatre that I'm a trustee of. But as he said to me about 2 months ago, he's also another 50 theatres as well.
Hadn't he opened the fourth toilet block at a theatre in the last 6 months or something or other?
Yeah, he did. He did. But it was, we got a lot of money to open it, but I would say to any chief exec, grab it and maximise it.
Yeah, but you don't want to look at it as a sweating of your asset, I think, David. I don't know if you remember on the podcast that we had about Malaria No More and David Beckham in his Perspex box full of mosquitoes and the number of looks, likes, etc. that they had because of that YouTube few minutes was extraordinary.
And also, I think, you know, we need to go back and think about what happened in Kids Company and then in Oxfam for those celebrities there who actually had to run because of their reputation.
There's method behind our madness of just aimlessly talking about celebrity involvement with charity, in that in recent months an individual did something extraordinary, became a celebrity all of his own simply because of doing a charitable act. That's the clue, as it were, to who our guest is going to be. It's not actually the celebrity, we should say, or should be careful about. That's a clue as to the charity that we're looking at today. Camilla and Keith, we better introduce ourselves. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
Fabulous. Let's get our guest in. Well, this is very exciting because our guest today is the chief executive of a charity called NHS Charities Together. Now, up until a few months ago, you may not have heard of this organisation because it has had an extraordinary boost in public support and an extraordinary individual who probably more than anybody else has started the ball rolling. And we're talking, of course, about Captain Tom, the gentleman coming out to his 100th birthday who decided to do something very modest, to walk with the aid of a walking frame around his garden and for charity, and he raised an extraordinary amount of money. So the chief executive of NHS Charities is Ellie Orton. Previous to that, she was the chief executive of Kairos Women Working Together. She was head of youth programmes, then interim chief executive at the John Egging Trust, a youth and community worker with Warwickshire Council before that, and a youth and community worker with the Church of England as well. But tell us about when you first heard about Captain Tom and what he was planning to do.
Thank you. Yes, so Captain Tom's daughter actually tweeted us when he first started walking, and she just said, wonder if you'd be interested in our story. My father is a 99-year-old veteran. We've challenged him to walk his garden 100 times before his 100th birthday in aid of NHS Charities Together. We think it's a really nice story. And she was absolutely right.
Did you have a part in it? Did you sort of consciously think this is going to be massive?
We had launched our COVID-19 appeal about a week earlier. It had done amazingly well in the first 5 days, brought £15 million in really quickly. The coronavirus and the global pandemic and lockdown and all the emotions and all the pressures that went with that, the country's response in terms of what can I do is they wanted to help their beloved NHS, and particularly their beloved NHS staff who have been there for them through thick and thin. And that completely relates to Captain Tom's story. You know, his motivation was he has had amazing care from the NHS and he wanted to give back, say thank you and do something to help. And I've had so many people that have said to us, you know, he was my story of lockdown. You know, he was the one that helped me get through this. So it was definitely a story of hope.
And when you saw the total figure, the figure creeping up and up and up, what was your reaction to the size of the amount that we ended up with? It was about 33 million, I think.
Yeah, it's 33 million. I remember on Twitter on a weekend of Piers Morgan saying, come on, let's get this man to £500,000. And me thinking, oh my goodness, you know, for an individual doing a in aid of charity event, you know, a sponsored walk, that is incredible. And then by the end of that day, it was over a million. And then in one day, it went up by something like 5 million in one day. And I'd be doing BBC Breakfast or ITV Breakfast with the Moore family. And as we're watching it, you're seeing that the numbers on Just Giving just rising and rising and rising, and absolutely incredible. I mean, but equally, I know that the pressure that put on the family was also, you know, really difficult.
So here you have this enormous pot of money. You're in the middle of your own shock, personal and organisational. You've got media coming out of everywhere, and you've got to think, how do I receive that money, turn it around, give it to the organisations that need it? So how did you organise your time?
During the peak of the pandemic, which was also the peak of the kind of frenzy of our income, so we raised over £100 million in 6 weeks. 33 million of that is Captain Tom Moore, but I don't think we definitely didn't anticipate £100 million in 6 weeks. So really, first thing I did was bring in help. We are a team of four people as an organisation, virtually full-time, but we have fantastic reach and a fantastic membership and fantastic partnerships. So I reached out to our partnership with CCLA, who are ethical investment company, and just said, I need you to set up an account for us that is going to hold quite a lot of money. And from that account, I need to be able to grant to my 140 member charities, which is what we had at the time, very, very quickly. How can you help? Their chief executive brought together a strategic meeting that day. And within 24 hours, we had a charitable COIF account with CCLA set up. We had a team from there that was helping to manage and look after that account. My members also helped amazingly. So I went out to the members and said, is anyone furloughing staff at this time? So Birmingham Hospitals University Charity, they gave me six members of staff pretty much straight away, junior fundraisers, who then came on board to help us with our, at the time we had one inbox, info@, which was just thousands and thousands of emails a day. So they were helping to clear that. I then reached out to somebody to be able to support us on our communications, because we didn't have a communications team. I had a digital content officer who had started 3 weeks before lockdown, who was very new, very capable, absolutely amazing, but very new. And then also very soon after that, we reached out to a communications agency after a conversation with the director of communications at NHS England, of me just going, help. He literally sent me this, shared a contact on my mobile and sent it to me and literally just said, contact this person. And I was like, right, thank you.
Excellent. How fast did you get the first money out?
So we launched on the 23rd of March, the beginning of lockdown, and the first funds went out by the 1st of April.
Wow.
Give us a sense of what sort of projects can now be done, the money that people have been giving, where that is going now.
We've granted out over £20 million on that immediate care, immediate support. The things that that has been funded are the wellbeing rooms that for a lot of staff that have been set up in hospitals, food, accommodation, parking, iPads for patients who are isolated. So it's been that kind of immediate support area. We are currently have funding that going out that is specifically asking the questions about how have communities who have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19 being supported, and prioritising those grants. So that's BAME staff and communities, but also those with disabilities or more hidden communities. And then we go on to the community partnerships. That is being done in England on a strategic care partnership level, the new integrated care systems way. So we'll have a lead charity within each of those, and they identify where those funds should be spent. And then the final area is the long-term recovery. And I really think those last two areas that I've just talked about, we will continue to fundraise, because actually those are the two areas that those things don't just stop. You know, we continually need to be able to work in partnerships, work in support. The information that's now coming out about the patients' long-term recovery who have gone through COVID and come out of ICU and ICS, and they are, you know, they're quite extraordinary, and we don't know quite what that looks like yet. Also, you know, mental health recovery of staff. For those that have been on the front line, post-traumatic stress disorder will be a factor, but also those that have been on the supporting within the NHS, you know, fatigue and just feeling overwhelmed and having to go back now to picking up old lists, that is automatically going to affect you as a NHS staff member and how you feel about that. So having that long-term commitment to the well-being and the recovery of staff, I think, is vital for us.
Can I just take you back, OK? Because obviously this fast growth, this acceleration, you know, is challenging in itself. But I will be honest, I hadn't heard of you. When did the charity start? Who started it? And any idea why?
We were started informally as the Association of NHS Charities in 2000 by some of the bigger NHS charities across the country. So Great Ormond Street, The Christie, Nottingham University, Sheffield, Birmingham Children's. There was a number of the larger charities that were actively fundraising, and they'd decided to come together. We formally constituted and registered as a charity in 2009 and started with about 70 members, appointed the first chief executive who worked with the charity to really grow this mutual support and benefit, increase the capability and capacity of NHS charities, particularly around governance, particularly around, you know, financial management, and but also fundraising.
Are you actually dealing and supporting with a lot of smaller charities now, or is it just based on the big ones?
So yeah, we now have 240 members. When we started the campaign in March, we had 140 members, but the majority of those charities were and are actively fundraising. Not necessarily all of them, but majority of them. Some are specialist charities from specialist trusts, some are acute trusts, some mental health and community, some are ambulance trusts. And then within the devolved charities, you have health boards.
I was going to ask, I mean, it must be very difficult when you have such an extraordinary expansion of the size of your organisation. Does it put strains on what your aims and objectives were? Because clearly, you know, money comes in, you think, well, we could do this, we could do that. Your eyes are diverted, as it were. How much strain did it put on that? And how much did you look at your aims and objectives and think, actually, can we do something else? Should we be doing something else?
So we had a five-year strategy that really by 2023, which was the 75th birthday of the NHS, we wanted to be a national brand and to be having a national income that we would grant out to our members. So we had this ambition. We were looking particularly at grants that would increase activity, that therefore improve health, and that they would be NHS projects. So basically, you just need to flip that upside down. So what happened with COVID is that the profile and the success has come, but the capacity and the capabilities are now lacking. So we have now got a big job on our hands, certainly reviewing the vision and the mission and the objects.
So now you've got a seat at the table, which is what everybody wants. And one of the tables will be the government table. And here's the NHS, which, as Nigel Lawson apparently said, is the religion of the British people, and you've got an organization such as yourself, which is a charity, and you've got a government organization, which, shall we say, pays the wages. How do you think going forward that is going to mesh? And do you have any concerns, for example, that government's going to say, well, you did fantastically, carry on?
I think we have to look in context. So partly the context of bringing in £130 million is basically runs the NHS for a day. But also NHS charities have, you know, they've been working in partnership with the NHS since 1948. You know, they are prior to the NHS are the charities. And they are very clear that they are there to help the NHS do more. It is not a one or the other. It's what can we do together, and together we can do more. And when you're looking at what is best for the patient and what is best for the public in terms of charity, actually working in partnership with statutory organisations is what is best. Lots of them raise funds for equipment, for research, for new buildings, for capital, but also those slightly softer things around well-being. A big thing that has come out of COVID-19 is the well-being of staff, which was an area that some charities looked at quite well and other charities actually shied away from, because their definition of patient benefit meant patient got the money. And one of the big outcomes has been these well-being rooms and well-being hubs for staff that have been set up in a lot of the acute settings.
Let's bring in Alex Scales, Alex from the Cass Centre for Charity Effectiveness. Alex, you're here listening to Ellie's story, this extraordinary growth of a charity from not quite zero, but from a very small base to a very large, substantial concern. And you obviously speak to and teach the charity leaders of the future. What can we get from this particular extraordinary story?
Well, I mean, just on an individual level, Ellie's she's already sharing so much that others can learn from. And I can't wait to invite you, Ellie, to come and share your leadership experiences in front of the room of students and future leaders. But one of the things I'm really interested in, obviously from this opportunity comes great responsibility for your whole organisation and your board, but particularly you. And I'm wondering, over the last 12 months, what coping mechanisms you may have brought into play to help you navigate your way through this fantastic opportunity. But as you have underscored, and others know all too well, coming with that comes immense challenge.
Yeah, definitely. I think on an organisational level, I can't underestimate the challenge it's been for our board of trustees. You know, they were governing this charity that was forecasting £500,000 income for the year. And, you know, before they got to the end of the first quarter, or just after the end of the first quarter, they were sitting on £100 million. I think for me as a leader, definitely asking for help. And if people offer help, just saying yes. Yes, please. Do you want me to do that? Yes, please. I think one of my key strengths is I'm actually quite driven, but I have quite a high level of endurance. So I can just work and work and work. And I'm very fortunate to have an amazing husband who has been amazing with our three children. And actually, there are some parts of lockdown, like not having to do swimming lessons, not having to get to brownies and guides and all those things that, as a parent, you kind of constantly literally just, ferrying people around, because all those things were stopped. Yeah, I actually therefore was able to sit in front of my computer for 15 hours a day, nonstop, every single day. And I don't think it's definitely not perfect. And there probably are days when I've gone, can we just quit? Can I just walk away now? But you know that, you know, that actually that's not really how I feel. It's just how I feel at the time. You know, I just need to be able to see light at the end of the tunnel, I think. You know, crisis leadership is actually quite easy. Decisions need to be made, direction needs to be given, and you need to know people are going to follow you. And as long as you've got those things, then that's fine. And you've got the expertise to be able to make those decisions quickly. But I started doing meetings again just with the four members of staff that I have, looking at my organisational development. And I just said to them, it's going to be bumpy. And please prioritise your well-being. You know, please now be taking your weekends. But that's how it feels now. It's slightly more challenging than actually just being in the pressure of the crisis.
I think the danger zone is there. okay, about falling over for you and all your staff. And I know some of the chief execs who, they just hit the floor.
Yeah.
And the danger with that, obviously, is that the organisation needs to keep going. So there needs to be things in place that not necessarily can step in and take over, but so the boundaries are there so that people need to manage. At this stage, what do you think your biggest risks are then?
I think because we're at this stage where we're bringing in the extra resources and extra team, I really think those decisions have literally only just been made. The trustees have got assurances that what I'm saying is the way we should be going and the roles and responsibilities that they're happy with so that we can now appoint to those. But in that, the risk is we're still really, really busy. So the capacity of the team and just the burnout of the team, at the moment, the biggest risk for us is the impact that's having on performance.
And it's about pace as well as balance, isn't it? You know, as a leader, I think we've talked about it previously, but the, you know, in part, the speed of strategy is being driven by the external environment that everybody finds themselves in at the moment. So the challenge for leaders is finding that pace such that they can bring others with them to develop and implement those actions that they can see would create so much benefit.
I was going to say, who are your role models, as it were, in managing organisations? Who are you leaning on? Who are your mentors, in a way?
It was a real privilege for me to work with the Red Arrows, who are one of the best of the best teams in the world in terms of high performance and performing under pressure. And having, you know, come through an organisation that did leadership programmes with young people, with the military, there is an awful lot to learn there, you know, particularly around, you know, human factors, etc., in leadership. But I'm still good friends with the OC of the Red Arrows, who's just come back to be the OC of the Red Arrows. I don't particularly do lots of talking about leadership with him and his partner, who's a good friend of mine. But we also have a number of different quotes around our house. Bobby Kennedy, you know, the purpose of life is to contribute it to make things better. And also I'm a big fan of Simon Sinek and, you know, knowing your why. In fact, we were supposed to be over Easter going to see him in London. That got cancelled as well. Bloody corona.
You probably learnt more during the period of lockdown by a natural process than you would have done in going there. Alex?
One question that I'm really intrigued by is, obviously, everything that you've done in the last few months has been done by necessity, online, virtually. Do you think as you build and create the organisation that sits at the centre of the strategy, do you think virtual and online will be a major part of that, or are you all busting to go back to property based face to face, what we used to do before mid March?
In terms of modern working, you know, we all want a life balance. You know, those of us who are parents, we absolutely share our parenthood. We have three children. We want to be able to pick up, take to school when we can, go to assemblies. If you understand that your job is about performance and that you've got the trust to be able to get on and do that job and to deliver, then actually those other things are really important and actually affect how high performing you can be. I'm having this conversation with one of our team members, and him saying to me, I'm an extrovert, I really didn't think that working from home was going to suit me, and actually realised that I'm talking to people constantly, that actually I'm doing more within the, you know, 3 hours that I've got. So, yeah, I'd like to move forward with a little bit of both. It would be nice to actually get in a room, though, with some people.
Because I think I read somewhere, you know, and I like this bit, okay, if you're supporting it, you think there's a lot more need in the charity sector for charities to join up. Is that because you don't feel that there's the benefit of some of the spending that we've got going on at the moment, and that you think that working together will create a better outcome?
I definitely think that partnership working is the way forward, and that's not about membership of NHS Charities Together. That is about, I really believe that NHS charities sit as this bridge between the rest of the voluntary sector and the NHS, that they understand both languages. The NHS doesn't work in a silo. It completely relies on partnerships with the voluntary sector and partnerships with the social care sector to provide the very best care for patients. And so now more than ever, the NHS is going to rely on those partnerships. Talked about my background earlier as youth work and specialist social care. Early intervention and prevention and partnership working and integration is what we've been doing for years and years and years in that sector. And it needs to transform into health. We as patients of the NHS completely rely on a myriad of different ways of being able to access care for our health. And that includes, men's mental health. Going to the darts club is a way of supporting men, middle-aged men or older men's mental health, because they get amongst each other, they talk, they're not isolated. Those things have a role to play in health, and so we need to look at things through a health agenda.
There's a lot of laughing going on there is because I play darts twice a week, okay? So I fit that group that you're talking about.
Maybe you can get a grant.
Yeah, and what great support, if you think about all the benefits that you get to talk to your mates, to socialise, your well-being, all of those things, that actually, we need to look at how we support our wider community sector through eyes of health.
Thank you so much, Ellie. We've clearly taken far too much time out of your 15-hour days. Keep going and take that break as soon as you can. We all wish you well. It's been an amazing journey that you've been on, and thanks for sharing some of the experiences that you've had thus far.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege to talk to you all.
Hey, we got that full on, didn't we?
That's the extraordinary person, Ellie Orton.
We got the lot, didn't she? She's really in a challenging place at the moment with everything you wish for, almost. I want lots of money, and now I've got it, and it's like now they're going to have to deliver it. And the challenge, I think, that comes down to a lot of small charities as well, is the same. The principle is the same, which is as soon as you get a lot of money, it puts a lot of pressure on the whole charity and the whole workforce. And then the important bit is how you manage that through.
One of the questions I never like to ask people, and I hate asked in interviews, is how do you feel? Because I think it's such a lazy question. But really, what was evident was how she felt. She feels exhausted. She's getting every single thought that she has ever had about the process out there. She's trying to kind of coalesce things. She hasn't even been able really to think about the beginning of the next stage. She knows it's there. She's feeling that letdown afterwards, where the energy seeps away from you. And somehow you have to manage to bring it all together again, demonstrate to your team that you're on it, give them some energy and support. What I really liked is that she said again and again how important well-being is, how important asking for help is, how important the support team is, and if the support team works well, then everybody works well. Then the patient gets better care. Then the aftercare is better. The recovery is better. And that applies to organizations. And I think that really came across.
Alex?
Yeah, for me, I think, what an incredible position to be in terms of, the organization. But it came across that she's very, very focused on, that clarity of purpose that we've talked about before, those tightly defined parameters. Ellie quoted Simon Sinek, knowing your why, as one of her favourite quotes. But I think that will really, really help keep them grounded during what is undoubtedly going to be a challenging time.
And I know we talked before on this podcast about the need for chief execs, people running charities, to have time to think, time to kind of pause, reflect, make sure that they are on the right track. And yet this is someone who hasn't had time to do any of that, because as soon as the focus was on her, as soon as this extraordinary amount of money from Captain Thomas More had suddenly come in, she's actually in demand because we need PPE equipment. You know, I mean, as soon as the money's coming in the door, there are calls for it to go out as quickly as possible. And I thought it was very impressive. Actually, Camilla, you talked about it. We got it down to a matter of just a few days after that focus. They realised that they had an urgency to provide PPE equipment, to get stuff out there to those frontline workers.
No, and I think it's almost having a military mind and that precision, that focus, but also, again, the support team, as in, you know, the army marches on its stomach. You do have to eat. You do have to stop. You do have to sleep. I sort of felt, and maybe wrongly, that in a way this podcast was offering her the opportunity to sit for an hour and think about what she might have done, reflect on it, think about where she's going, touching base with all her different foci, and saying, yes, this is right, and I'm doing it right.
We will be back with some more very shortly. The website, if you want to check us out, it's goodcharitybadcharity.com. Please rate and review and tell your friends about this podcast, particularly if they're working in the charity sector. Feel free to email us through the website with any suggestions for guests or topics. We're indebted to our partners at the Centre for Charity Effectiveness at CAST Business School. From us all, a goodbye and stay safe.